Why is this so important to the Christian fascists, as well as to other religious fundamentalist zealots? Well, you can think back to what happened when Galileo came and Copernicus discovered and illustrated the fact that the earth was not the center of the universe, and man was not the end point and highest point of creation of all of God, but in fact the earth was just a planet that revolved along with other planets around the sun. What did the church at that time, just a few hundred years ago, do? They tortured or threatened to torture Galileo, a scientist, in order to and succeeded in forcing him to renounce this discovery of scientific fact because they believed, and not without any reason, that this would upset the whole feudal order where everybody had a place, everybody was born into a place, and you belonged in that place and couldn't change place. And, you know, that God was at the top of this whole hierarchy down to the poorest person on the bottom. And even Thomas Aquinas, a scholar in the Middle Ages, said that inanimate objects like rocks had a definite place in this whole perfect order. And saying that the earth was not the center of the universe would upset this whole thing, which indeed it did. It was part of the bourgeois revolution which rose up and got rid of feudalism. So the church threatened to torture Galileo for teaching this basic truth. And basically these Christian fundamentalists are doing the same thing today. It's their view that if you teach how reality actually is, in this important sphere in particular, how life came into being through the natural processes without any need of or role by God, and how human beings evolve through that whole process, the whole order will come undone. Not only will religious authority be undermined and perhaps overthrown, but the political structure and the whole economic system will be undermined and perhaps overthrown. This is what they believe. And here's a question that should be asked thinking about politics in this country today. Why is this stand on evolution not made a big issue in the mainstream politics of society? Do you hear it being raised in the election now, for example, by Kerry? Now, Bush, as we know, when asked about this during the last election, what do you think of evolution, said, the jury is still out. In other words, this is not an established scientific fact, which it is, beyond any reasonable dispute. The jury is still out. Because he didn't want to undermine these religious fundamentalists who are a lot of his own backing but are also carrying out and a key force in carrying out the program that he's pushing forward. So why isn't this a big issue? Where in the so-called liberal media are the prominent mainstream voices, and where is John Kerry for that matter, insisting that this position of Bush's, of willful ignorance and backwardness on such a decisive question as evolution, should in and of itself disqualify Bush from being the quote-unquote leader of the free world? Why is it not said that he can't be the chief executive and military commander of modern and enlightened U.S. imperialism, which is set out to remake Iraq, Afghanistan, and indeed the whole world in its enlightened image and under its domination? Where are the voices saying, how can Bush be the leader of this when he won't even say that evolution is a fact? Now, all this reminds me of a bumper sticker that someone sent me, knowing that I'm deep into a lot of the questions, wrangling with the questions of religion, and particularly the danger posed by religious fundamentalism. And the bumper sticker said, when religion ruled the world, they called it the Dark Ages. Now, that may be, one-sided in today's context, but there is a point to it. Not when people practice religion, but when religion had such a dominant role in the Middle Ages as it did have a great deal to do with spreading and maintaining ignorance and superstition. Now, look at this whole thing that developed, for example, around the Supreme Court case that eventually developed under God phrase, one nation under God. It was very interesting that this guy, Michael Nidau, who brought this case, himself, rather than getting a lawyer, he was a lawyer, but he hadn't been practicing law. But he went before the Supreme Court and argued the case himself. And every article, even in the mainstream press, said this guy clearly had the most, you know, compelling case, the greatest logic, the most cogent argument, as they say, and yet he's almost certainly going to lose. And what was his argument? His argument was there's supposed to be separation of church and state. In the Declaration of Independence, it refers to nature and nature's God, but God never is mentioned in the Constitution, and for good reason, because the people who founded the country didn't want a religious theocracy, a rule by a religious aristocracy insisting on their version of religion being the basis for law and for everything in society. So they put right in the Constitution that there should not be an official religion. People should be free and not and hindered in practicing religion, but there should be no state-sponsored religion. And then what happened? You had this phrase, one nation. And then in the 1950s, during the Cold War, the Congress of the United States and the president passed a law adding under God, precisely and explicitly and very openly, in order to contrast the United States with the atheistic, communistic Soviet Union, to say, we are a religious country. That was the whole purpose of adding under God. And as this guy Michael Nidau pointed out in the Supreme Court arguments, when one of the justices said, well, this is just kind of a general phrase. It doesn't really mean that much anymore. He said, I have a hard time believing that under God means no God. This was obviously put in there to promote religion by the state. That's clearly a violation of the Constitution. And, of course, he was right. But the reason all of these fundamentalists got up in arms about this is because this is also part of their program of actually trying to install a fascistic theocracy, a rule by a religious aristocracy in this country that they see as necessary in order to promote and expand the rule of this empire throughout the world and hold this society together, because otherwise it'll come apart at the seams and fly in many different directions. And they say so openly. Well, turning aside now from the Christian fascists, reactionary Christian fundamentalists, what about the attempt to use the Bible, and in particular the New Testament, and more particularly the words of Jesus himself, as the basis for fighting against or opposing oppression and injustice, and the basis for tolerance and diversity? Now, many people have spoken and written about the religious impulse in people. Why do people turn toward religion? Why do people feel the need for religion? Of course, there are many different reasons. Some people take up religion in order to enforce oppression. For example, throughout the history of slavery in the southern U.S., the Bible was used, in particular the book of Genesis, to justify slavery. It was said that Ham, the son of Noah, was cast into Africa and a curse was put upon him, and therefore the people of Africa were cursed, and therefore it was right to be able to enslave them. This was the argument of the southern slave owners and others who defended slavery for hundreds of years. Other people take up religion to oppose oppression, or to side with the oppressed, or to seek some sort of way to find some solace in a world that seems to haunt them and injure them at every turn. Now, Marx made the famous statement that many people are aware of, in which he described religion's role as like that of a narcotic. He said, religion is the opiate of the people, referring to opium. But Marx also went on to say that what many who embrace religion are in fact seeking is what he termed the heart of a heartless world. They're looking for some comfort in a world that's so cold and brutal. And many are hoping for a better life in the future in another world, since this one seems so terrible and hopeless. But can religion actually provide this for people in any fundamental and long-term way? The problem is that, as Marx put it, like a narcotic, the relief or escape provided by this kind of religious belief is never sufficient, does not last long, and soon turns into another chain on the people, another thing on which they become dependent. And more fundamentally than all that, The point is that we do not want, and moreover, we do not need any longer to be imprisoned within a heartless world. We need and can bring into being a world with heart, a world freed of oppression and misery imposed and enforced by the way human society is structured and controlled. A world in which people do not think of and treat each other as mere objects to be used and profited from, which is all the common way, of course, in this society. Religion, at least as practiced by more truly compassionate and progressive-minded people today, may aim at providing consolation to people in their agony and torment. But we can bring into being a world in which people no longer need this kind of consolation, because poverty and oppression and all the needless suffering bound up with all of that can be and will be finally eliminated. But the point is, to do that, we need to confront reality as it actually is. We need to engage and transform reality, including human society as well as nature, with a consciously and consistently scientific outlook and method. And the point is, for the first time in human history, there is now the possibility to do just that. Measured against that, religion, religious doctrine and tradition, and the religious way of conceiving reality all fall way short, and in the end lead away from what for the first time has actually become possible for humanity. And this is definitely true of Christianity, no less than other religions. I've talked about what Christianity upholds and defends. I've talked about how Paul, for example, in the New Testament, in addition to what's in the Old Testament, upholds and defends the subordinate and oppressed position of women, and upholds and defends slavery, and calls on people to be obedient to earthly authority, because, as he says in Romans 13, it would not be constituted as authority if it were not ordained by God. And let's look at what is revealed, or what is taken as a given, taken for granted in the parables of Jesus himself. For example, the parable of the weeds among the wheat, the parable of the unforgiving servant, the parable of the wicked tenants, the parable of the great dinner. All these are things in which it is assumed that there are people who are slave masters and others who are slaves, people who are landlords and other people who work and slave for them as tenants. Or there's the parable of the 10 virgins that you find in Matthew 25, 1-13. This is not an innocent term in the Bible, virgins. The whole idea that a woman has to be a virgin, even though this is not about the virgins being married, just the reference to virgins, this whole concept in the Bible, going back to the Old Testament, has been a form down to today that has brutally oppressed women and led to the most horrendous things being done against women. For example, if you go back to the Old Testament, Deuteronomy 22, verses 13 and 21, here is what is said about the question of a woman who is or is not a virgin when she gets married. Listen about this and think what it's actually saying as you hear it. It's called, in the Bible I have, the subheading is The Accused Bride. This is in Deuteronomy 13 and following. Suppose a man marries a woman, but after going into her, in other words, having sex with her, he dislikes her and makes up charges against her, slandering her by saying, I married this woman, but when I lay with her, I did not find evidence of her virginity. The father of the young woman and her mother shall then submit the evidence of the young woman's virginity to the elders of the city at the gate. Now, what does this mean? The father of the young woman shall say to the elders, I gave my daughter in marriage to this man, but he dislikes her. Now he has made up charges against her. I did not find evidence of your daughter's virginity, but here is the evidence of my daughter's virginity. Then they shall spread out the cloth before the elders of the town. Just in case you're missing what's being said here, they're going to take the sheet from when the man went into the woman, and if it's not bloody, it means she wasn't a virgin, and they're going to spread it out before the elders of the town. First of all, you have the humiliation that's involved in this and the degradation that's involved. But that's not all. They shall fine him, that is the accusing husband, because he has slandered a virgin of Israel. She shall remain his wife. He shall not be permitted to divorce her as long as he lives. In other words, she might not want to stay married to him, but she has nothing to say about it after all this. But, he goes on, if, however, this charge is true, that evidence of the young woman's virginity was not found, then they shall bring the young woman out to the entrance of the father's house, and the men of the town shall stone her to death. Think of all the suffering that has resulted from and continues to result from this whole notion down to today in countries throughout the world, especially where the scriptures, not only of Islam, but of Christianity and Judaism, are insisted upon in a literal way and must be taken, every word of them, to the letter. Going back to the parables and the sayings of Jesus, we see once again, as I said, that it's not so much that he upholds or promotes slavery, he just assumes it as a given in the world. For example, when he says, a disciple is not above the teacher, nor a slave above the master. It is enough for the disciple to be like the teacher and the slave like the master. This is Matthew 10, 24 and 25. So here you see, he's not saying, let's rise up and overthrow slavery. He's just assuming it as a given and making comparisons between the master or the heavenly father and the slave owner, which of course assumes then or reinforces the idea that slavery is acceptable. He accepts these things as given and uses them as points of reference for the relation between God and human beings. Even though we see throughout the Bible that Jesus expresses sympathy with the poor, the oppressed, the afflicted, and the outcast, and even though he calls for acts of kindness toward them and carries out such acts himself, Jesus' mission, as portrayed in his own words and in the New Testament of the Bible overall, is not to put an end to oppression and suffering in this life, but to point people toward and prepare them for some salvation in another life. Even the way of life that Jesus calls on people to live while on earth does not point to the ending of oppression and exploitation, among other reasons because it does not even speak to, let alone provide the means for overthrowing and uprooting, the foundation and roots of this oppression and exploitation, and the institutions and instruments through which this exploitation and oppression are maintained and enforced. The work and the essential mission of Jesus, as they come through in the Bible, are also based on and accept the mythology of original sin and the fallen state of man, and of course of woman, and the whole view of humanity bound up with this, which, as I said, considers human beings fundamentally flawed, incapable of creating a better world on their own, and in need of salvation to be realized in some imaginary future existence through the grace of some supposed supernatural being. Meanwhile, on this earth, we are just left to suffer and wait for the future. Now, it's very interesting if you look at the Beatitudes, for example, the Sermon on the Mount, the Beatitudes, the blessed are the poor in spirit, etc. If you look in Matthew 5, verses 1 to 11, where you find the Beatitudes, for example, how do they end up? Verse 11, your reward is great in heaven. This is where the reward for enduring all this oppression on earth will finally be delivered, in an imaginary future world which does not exist. And I've already talked about how Jesus performs miracles by casting out demons and devils, by telling people that they are forgiven of their sins, as in the story of Jesus supposedly healing a paralyzed man by telling him his sins are forgiven, Luke 5, 17 to 26. Now, all of this is not just harmless. It spreads a great deal of ignorance and superstition, guilt and fear, which is instilled and reinforced in people, making them feel that their sickness, afflictions, and weaknesses are their own fault, are the result of sin, or are the result of forces beyond their control, demons and devils invading and possessing them. If you think this is harmless, think of the picture of the Mexican peasants, day after day, crawling on their bellies and on their faces in the stones, tearing up their flesh to a shrine to pray for forgiveness in order to be healed of wounds, afflictions, ways in which they are crippled and ill. Now here's a question that should be asked. If Jesus is the Son of God, an all-knowing, all-powerful God, why did Jesus not know better than this? Why did Jesus go around curing people, supposedly, by casting out demons that didn't exist and don't exist? Or if it's argued that Jesus did know better, but chose to speak to people in the terms of the times, since people then believed in demons and devils, why did he not instead tell people the truth and help them understand reality as it actually is? For example, what really causes epilepsy and other causes of sickness? Why did Jesus instead reinforce ignorance, superstition, guilt, and fear? Now, what really was Jesus' vision and program for humanity, if you want to put it that way? If you look at Matthew 22, verses 34 to 40, you see it laid out in a very concentrated way. He boils all the commandments down to two commandments, one main one and another one. The first and highest commandment is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. And the second one is love your neighbor as yourself. Well, of course, this is better than actively promoting and advocating hatred of humanity and slaughtering and plundering your neighbor. But can this really lead to the things that humanity needs? Let's examine this briefly. To begin with, in regard to the first commandment, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and all your mind. The reality is that there is no God. So there's no God to love with anything. So for that fundamental reason, it's not possible to carry out this commandment. But for the sake of pursuing this further, let us for the moment set aside the fact that there is no God. If there were a God, the God Jesus would have to be talking about is the God of the Jewish scriptures, the Old Testament of the Bible from which I've been citing things. That is a God Jesus was familiar with, and those are the scriptures he makes reference to. And a person who is seeking to do good in the world could not and should not love a God like that. As for the second commandment, in reality, it is not possible to love all your neighbors. Once again, in a world marked by profound class divisions and social inequalities, it is not possible in reality to love and to act out of love for everyone, regardless of the class position they occupy and the role they play in society and in relation to other classes and groups of people. If you love, to put it simply, if you love the exploiters and oppressors, you cannot really love those they exploit and oppress. If you act out of love for the one, you cannot really objectively act out of love for the other, because simply their needs and interests are fundamentally and antagonistically opposed to each other. There can be no reconciliation between them on the basis of love or on any other basis, because in the real world, they will be compelled to act in ways that are opposed to, and in a definite sense, harmful to, the needs and interests of the other. Slaves and slave masters cannot all embrace each other in a reconciliation of love. And as a matter of fact, attempting such a reconciliation will only aid the oppressors, exploiters, and slave masters, because they already hold a position of domination and are very happy to have reconciliation preached to those under this domination. And in general, they are happy to maintain the status quo which such reconciliation will serve. Now, it's very interesting that in the early history of Christianity, some people don't know this, but the slogan of communism is, from each according to their ability to each according to their needs. Interestingly enough, this was actually taken by Marx and Engels, the founders of communism, from the book of Acts in the Bible. Not what was put forward in the Bible, but this particular slogan. Because in describing how the early Christian communities lived, before the whole big, structure and institutions and hierarchy of the church developed as a powerful institution, and definitely before Christianity became the official religion of Rome, in the early Christian communities, You had many poor people, but also people of more means, people with more money. And so what would happen is people had more money would support the poorer people. And they'd bring whatever they had and they'd divide up the food and other means to live. And that's the way these early Christian communities lived. They lived by each providing what they could and each taking what they needed. But the problem is that this was in little pockets, little enclaves within a society which was based on slavery and oppression of all kinds and plundering and conquering other peoples. And the people who had more to give were basing that on and drawing that from this exploitation and plunder that was carried out under this system. And what would have been necessary would have been to overthrow that whole system and do away with that exploitation and oppression. And of course, the basis did not exist at that time for that to happen in the Roman Empire. There was not a class of people, and there was not an understanding that could enable that to happen. So inevitably, these early Christian communities ended up abandoning the practice and orientation of from each according to their ability to each according to their needs, and instead developed a hierarchical Christian church and institutions and structures which became very oppressive themselves and persecuted heretics and others who had a different view of Christianity. And this became magnified once again after Constantine and after Christianity was adopted as the official religion of Rome. But it's not just the Christian fundamentalists, it's not just the church as an institution that insists that Christianity is the only way to God and the only way to salvation. If you believe the Bible, then you have to know that these are the words of Jesus himself. For example, if you look in John chapters 14 and 15, you will see that he says directly that he is the only way and that if you do not follow that way, you will be condemned to eternal damnation. So the problem is that when the Christian fundamentalists say this, as they do, they are in line with the Bible and in line with what Jesus says. And there's another question that has to be asked. And that is, if Jesus were really the Son of God, why did predictions that he made of the most fundamental kind not in fact come to pass, as they say? If you look in Matthew, for example, chapter 16, verses 27 and 28, you will see that Jesus says, there as well as elsewhere, that all this, the second coming, the coming of his kingdom, will happen very soon. In fact, in those verses he says, this generation alive today will live to see this. And Paul said the same thing many times in his writings. Well, how could Jesus be wrong about something so fundamental as that? Christians have been waiting 2,000 years for this, and there have been many times when these millennial types have jumped out to say it's coming on Tuesday next year on September the 13th, only to revise it on September the 12th and say, I meant the year after that. Now, what all this shows is that Jesus was not a supernatural being, part of the same substance as God the Father, and at the same time, the Son of God himself. And I don't have time to get into the whole thing about the Trinity, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, which really nobody understands. But in fact, there is much that is revealed in the whole history of how this conception of the Trinity, going all the way back to Constantine and forward from there, came to be adopted through a great deal of struggle, violent conflict, and suppression of opposing views violently among early Christians. Now, John Dominic Crossan, who's sort of a liberal theologian who's written a lot about Jesus, wrote a book called Who Killed Jesus? And at the end of the book, he says the big crime of Christianity has been when it has insisted that it is the only way, that it knows the absolute truth, that this is the only valid religion, the only valid way. And he insists instead, from the point of view of considering himself a Christian, that really we have to recognize in reading the Bible and looking at all these conflicting scriptures and things that were left out of the Bible, that it's really all myth, metaphor, and a matter of interpretation. Well, that's a valid point of view that can be argued, but what's the conclusion from that? The conclusion is that it obviously then can't be imbued with or said to have any biblical or supernatural authority. It's just, once again, a matter of human invention and human interpretation of what humans have invented. The ideas of Jesus and his vision, what they will lead to all this has to be evaluated just like those of any other human being, without attempting to smuggle in any notion that they have divine authority behind them. And as I've already spoken to at some length, these ideas and that vision cannot and will not lead to another world, a radically new and better world, a world without oppression and exploitation, right here on earth, in this reality, which is the only reality we have. So as the foundation and orientation for fighting to uproot oppression, inequality, exploitation, and oppression, the Bible will not do. And it will not do as the basis for defeating the Christian fascists either. First of all, it is necessary to repudiate and forcefully refute the notion of the Bible, or any religious scripture or tradition, for that matter, as the divinely revealed word of a supernatural being which must be followed to the letter, in a literal sense and in every detail. It is necessary to firmly reject this as the basis for morality, for the relations among people, and for the unifying and guiding principles in society broadly, and in the relations between different societies or nations. It is necessary, first of all, in order to unite people as broadly as possible in the fight against injustice and against reactionary programs and forces in society like the Christian fascists. And as a matter of fact, while this might at first seem ironic or illogical, or as they say, counterintuitive at first glance, it is actually necessary to insist on this in order to win as many people as possible among the base of the Christian fascists away from that position. So long as you are trying to argue with the Christian fascists on the basis that the Bible is, after all, the divinely revealed word of a supernatural being, they have you at a disadvantage because they can insist on all these things that I've been talking about, and you have no basis to oppose them other than nitpicking. You have no basis to oppose them other than salad bar or buffet Christianity. And you are on the losing end of the logic because once you would say it's not, after all, the divinely revealed word of a supernatural being, then you're saying it's just like any other human thing. And you've thrown out the authority that the Bible is supposed to carry. On the positive side, or the other side, in order to actually get at and win away people from this Christian fundamentalist and reactionary position, this Christian fascism, it is necessary to talk to them and struggle with them over many events and questions socially and politically and culturally in society. But it's also necessary to bring out sharply the contradictions in the position they hold. As I was speaking to earlier, they themselves practice a form of salad bar or buffet Christianity. They themselves don't want to talk about things in the Bible that if they were being consistent, they should insist be upheld and applied. And the reason they don't want to do that, although some at the inner core have a program for bringing that out over time, but the reason most don't want to do that is they know or have a sense that these things fly in the face of what the great majority of humanity today considers decent and just. And that's a contradiction that has to be hammered at with these people. You can't go to them and be liberal and namby-pamby. You have to hammer at that and show them that if you're going to insist that the Bible be taken literally with the authority of God and applied in every detail to the letter, then these are all the things you have to actually go out, argue for, uphold, propagate, and apply, and fight for in society. And that contradiction is a very acute one, and the basis for beginning to raise at least doubts among many of these people, as you're struggling with them over all these social, political, ideological, and cultural questions in society. This is the way, and not some other way, that you begin to hit at and create cracks in the foundation of this Christian fascism. Then it is necessary to formulate and fight for what should be essential and unifying principles at this point in the struggle for a more just society. Principles which can serve as a common basis for a broad diversity of people and forces who, coming from many different perspectives, want to and need to unite to oppose as powerfully as possible the reactionary offensive directed from the highest circles of power in the U.S., and in particular the Christian fascist forces and their ruling class connections and backers all the way to the top, and to fight against oppression, and injustice as a whole. I think, for example, of the unifying principles of the Not in Our Name coalition that developed and is ongoing to oppose this whole juggernaut, this rolling monster of war and repression that's being carried out in a concentrated way by the Bush administration. Those principles united people of a broad diversity in opposition to this juggernaut. People could come at that from many different ways, but they could unite against the core principles that we don't want to be, and we don't want to live in the new Rome, dominating and plundering the rest of the world, and we don't want people's rights trampled on internationally or in this country. And the statement of conscience that was signed by thousands and thousands of people, including many prominent intellectuals, artists, academics, and others, was a particularly concentrated expression of this kind of unity of broad forces who disagree on many things, even some things rather sharply, but were able to find a broad common ground in this statement on which they could go out to rally people to oppose this juggernaut. Or I think of the organization Refuse and Resist, which also has principles opposing repression and the whole direction that society is being taken and the world is being taken, which are open-ended and allow for different viewpoints, all the way from communists to people who are opposed to communism very sharply, but they can unite in this broad area of agreement. I think back also, and I think this is important, to something that was put forward in that supplement to our paper I referred to earlier, The Truth About Right-Wing Conspiracy and Why Clinton and the Democrats Are No Answer, which we put out during the Clinton impeachment process. And there, along with talking about important principles of political unity, it says that we need to strive for the following: values and cultural expressions that promote and celebrate equality between men and women and between peoples and nations, that stand against oppression and against violence which furthers and enforces such oppression, that oppose imperial domination by one nation over others and military bludgeoning to impose that domination, that foster relations among people based on an appreciation for diversity, but also for community. Values and culture that prize cooperation among people in place of cutthroat competition, that put the needs of people above the drive to accumulate wealth, that actually promote the global interests of humanity as opposed to narrow national antagonisms and great power domination. These are the kind of principles we need to forge and develop among a broad diversity of people, communists and many others, who want to fight against the whole direction in which society and the world is being dragged and the threat posed by this Christian fascist program and in general by the whole repressive and imperial agenda that's being fostered. Now, among these people, there will be many different visions, many different ideas of a just world and how to get there, many different notions of how these different ideas relate to struggle that should be waged now. But it should be possible, and it is urgently necessary, to struggle through those differences and to forge unity and to carry forward what we refer to as an ongoing process of unity, struggle, unity. Uniting broadly over the things we agree on, want to promote, and want to oppose, and struggling in a vital, vibrant, but comradely, friendly, and principled way over the differences we have, even profound differences, in the course of forging and carrying forward and further developing that unity. Now, to move to the conclusion, coming from the viewpoint, vision, and objectives of communists, what ideology and politics do we need? What outlook and methodology and program can provide the basis and direction for struggle that must be waged, and the great changes, the profound transformations that must be carried out in society and throughout the world? In the Communist Manifesto, Marx and Engels spoke of what they called two radical ruptures. They said the communist revolution represents the radical rupture, the break, the leap beyond traditional property relations and traditional ideas. What they were getting at was, with traditional property relations, is all the ideas of one person owning another, a man having a woman as a possession, one person owning, or as Noam Chomsky put it one time, renting other people and paying them wages, exploiting other people in one form or another, all the ways in which one race or nationality dominates another, one country seeks to plunder and dominate the world, All of those kind of relations need to be swept aside, and all of the ideas that arise from that those kind of relations and in turn reinforce those relations need to be swept aside. And we see one of the main phenomena going on in the world today as people are driven, for example, millions and millions of people each year throughout what's called the third world often are driven from their peasant situations where they're barely eking out an existence and then can no longer do so, into the cities where they're forced into slums and what are called shanty towns, barely able to survive. Half of the world is desperately trying to survive on $2 a day or less. 40,000 children are dying every day of hunger and preventable disease throughout the third world. 40,000 children. Now, I've said a lot against religion here, but one thing I did find very striking and powerful from a progressive religious person named Jim Wallace, whom I wrote some polemics against and struggled with his ideas in my book, Preaching from a Pulpit of Bones. But one thing I found very interesting and powerful is he cited the statistic, I think he said 35,000 instead of 40,000, but it makes no difference. And he said, this is like taking 3,500 jumbo jets, filling them up and deliberately crashing them into the ground every day. This is what's happening to children every day as we sit here throughout the third world, on top of all the suffering and oppression and injustice that we are all too familiar with right around us. And many people, particularly in this situation of being uprooted from their traditional situations and thrown into these areas, turn toward fundamentalist religion. Islamic fundamentalism, and we've seen some of the consequences of that, and Christian fundamentalism, for example, Pentecostalism. There's a growing phenomenon of people turning to Pentecostalism, not only in the U.S., but throughout Latin America, for example. Ashcroft is a Pentecostalist. That should tell us something. But there are many poor and oppressed people who turn to this because they don't see a way out, because their conditions don't lend them to feel collective strength with other people. So they turn to extreme religious views like this. And I was very interested to read in our paper, The Revolutionary Worker, a couple of months ago, a letter from a young guy who had been in a Pentecostal family in the United States. His family had gone from being very poor to being homeless for a good part of the time. His mother had become extremely steeped in this Pentecostal religion, really literally going around trying to drive, I don't know if this was in the article, but I've heard more about it, trying to drive the demons out of the house and so on. And he began to reject this as he got out into the world at large. He began to have an opportunity to begin reading and to begin going to a university and getting a broader view of the world. And he wrote an article in our paper, a letter in our paper called Losing My Religion, about how he broke with this. And this is what he said. Looking objectively at it all, I saw that we weren't being delivered of anything through this Pentecostal religion, only being delivered into distress because of the decisions we made and actions we took that were consistent with what we were taught in the Bible, in church. My mother is only one instance among many others within my extended family in which this grounding within religion has incurred continuous and consistent distraught in relationships and in material conditions. She, my family, and so many under this shroud of waiting for God's blessing while amidst unrelenting despair provided me with more than enough reasons to lose my religion. But even though I had all the reasons to completely let go of what was now to me an obsolete ideology, letting go completely would not be possible until I could find another mode of understanding and engaging reality, a mode that was consistent with the way things really were. And then he goes on to say that mode is the communist world outlook and methodology to which he was introduced through reading a book I wrote, Preaching from a Pulpit of Bones, which was required reading in a university class, interestingly. Communism promotes materialism as the basic understanding of the real world and the relation of people to the outside world or the larger world and of ideas to objective reality. Materialism in the understanding of communists is not what is commonly promoted as materialism. You go to the mall and buy as many things as you can. You scarf up as many consumer goods as you can possibly grab a hold of, and shopping becomes a national pastime. The acquisition of consumer goods is not what we mean by materialism. That's a common usage, but it's not what it means. Materialism refers to matter. It refers to the fact that all of existence is matter in motion. It really objectively exists. It's not in our minds. We do not create reality by an extension of our thinking, but in fact our thinking reflects in one way or another the reality that we experience and observe. This is a fundamental dividing line in how you approach the world and the idea or possibility of changing it. You hear all kinds of people opposing materialism by promoting what's called idealism philosophically, namely that reality is just the extension of different people's ideas. So, for example, you hear people say, well, that may be your reality, but my reality is different. God may not exist for you, but God exists for me very much. No. Either God doesn't exist for anybody or God exists for everybody. If there really is a God, I want to know about it. Because it makes everything completely different. And if there isn't a God, there isn't a God for anybody. And the Bible tells us that, you know, and other religions do. God is God for everybody. God is not God for those who believe in those, and not for those who don't. So reality is one way or the other. It is as it is. It is not as people want to create it in their minds. You hear this all the time, you know. Well, you know, different people have their own different realities. They even develop whole philosophical schools of things that are called postmodernism, where there isn't any objective reality. They're just different conceptions of reality that hold sway among different sections of people. Everybody has their own narrative. Each group in society has their own narrative that describes their reality, and nobody has anything to say or can pass any judgment on anybody else's narrative about reality. No. Reality exists objectively. If you go out of here and walk in front of a taxi cab on the streets of New York City, that reality will assert itself whether you think it will or not. And you can multiply those examples over and over again. That doesn't mean we know everything there is to know about reality at any given time, but it objectively exists and it is, and we can learn about it increasingly because it is. And because it's there objectively, and because it doesn't depend upon the thinking or the ideas or the prejudices or the wishes of people. This is a fundamental question that you can never really... Many different ideas of a just world and how to get there. Many different notions of how these different ideas relate to struggle that should be waged now. But it should be possible, and it is urgently necessary, to struggle through those differences and to forge unity and to carry forward what we refer to as an ongoing process of unity, struggle, unity. Uniting broadly over the things we agree on, want to promote, and want to oppose, and struggling in a vital, vibrant, but comradely, friendly, and principled way over the differences we have, even profound differences, in the course of forging and carrying forward and further developing that unity. Now, to move to the conclusion, coming from the viewpoint, vision, and objectives of communists, what ideology and politics do we need? What outlook and methodology and program can provide the basis and direction for struggle that must be waged, and the great changes, the profound transformations that must be carried out in society and throughout the world? In the Communist Manifesto, Marx and Engels spoke of what they called two radical ruptures. They said the communist revolution represents the radical rupture, the break, the leap beyond traditional property relations and traditional ideas. What they were getting at was, with traditional property relations, is all the ideas of one person owning another, a man having a woman as a possession, one person owning, or as Noam Chomsky put it one time, renting other people and paying them wages, exploiting other people in one form or another, all the ways in which one race or nationality dominates another, one country seeks to plunder and dominate the world, all of those kind of relations need to be swept aside, and all of the ideas that arise from that those kind of relations and in turn reinforce those relations need to be swept aside. And we see one of the main phenomena going on in the world today as people are driven, for example, millions and millions of people each year throughout what's called the third world often are driven from their peasant situations where they're barely eking out an existence and then can no longer do so, into the cities where they're forced into slums and what are called shanty towns, barely able to survive. Half of the world is desperately trying to survive on $2 a day or less. 40,000 children are dying every day of hunger and preventable disease throughout the third world. 40,000 children. Now, I've said a lot against religion here, but one thing I did find very striking and powerful from a progressive religious person named Jim Wallace, whom I wrote some polemics against and struggled with his ideas in my book, Preaching from a Pulpit of Bones. But one thing I found very interesting and powerful is he cited the statistic, I think he said 35,000 instead of 40,000, but it makes no difference. And he said, this is like taking 3,500 jumbo jets, filling them up and deliberately crashing them into the ground every day. This is what's happening to children every day as we sit here throughout the third world, on top of all the suffering and oppression and injustice that we are all too familiar with right around us. And many people, particularly in this situation of being uprooted from their traditional situations and thrown into these areas, turn toward fundamentalist religion. Islamic fundamentalism, and we've seen some of the consequences of that, and Christian fundamentalism, for example, Pentecostalism. There's a growing phenomenon of people turning to Pentecostalism, not only in the U.S., but throughout Latin America, for example. Ashcroft is a Pentecostalist. That should tell us something. But there are many poor and oppressed people who turn to this because they don't see a way out, because their conditions don't lend them to feel collective strength with other people. So they turn to extreme religious views like this. And I was very interested to read in our paper, The Revolutionary Worker, a couple of months ago, a letter from a young guy who had been in a Pentecostal family in the United States. His family had gone from being very poor to being homeless for a good part of the time. His mother had become extremely steeped in this Pentecostal religion, really literally going around trying to drive, I don't know if this was in the article, but I've heard more about it, trying to drive the demons out of the house and so on. And he began to reject this as he got out into the world at large and began to have an opportunity to begin reading and to begin going to a university and getting a broader view of the world. And he wrote an article in our paper, a letter in our paper called Losing My Religion, about how he broke with this. And this is what he said. Looking objectively at it all, I saw that we weren't being delivered of anything through this Pentecostal religion, only being delivered into distress because of the decisions we made and actions we took that were consistent with what we were taught in the Bible, in church. My mother is only one instance among many others within my extended family in which this grounding within religion has incurred continuous and consistent distraught in relationships and in material conditions. She, my family, and so many under this shroud of waiting for God's blessing while amidst unrelenting despair provided me with more than enough reasons to lose my religion. But even though I had all the reasons to completely let go of what was now to me an obsolete ideology, letting go completely would not be possible until I could find another mode of understanding and engaging reality, a mode that was consistent with the way things really were. And then he goes on to say that mode is the communist world outlook and methodology to which he was introduced through reading a book I wrote, Preaching from a Pulpit of Bones, which was required reading in a university class, interestingly. Communism promotes materialism as the basic understanding of the real world and the relation of people to the outside world or the larger world and of ideas to objective reality. Materialism in the understanding of communists is not what is commonly promoted as materialism. You go to the mall and buy as many things as you can. You scarf up as many consumer goods as you can possibly grab a hold of, and shopping becomes a national pastime. The acquisition of consumer goods is not what we mean by materialism. That's a common usage, but it's not what it means. Materialism refers to matter. It refers to the fact that all of existence is matter in motion. It really objectively exists. It's not in our minds. We do not create reality by an extension of our thinking, but in fact our thinking reflects in one way or another the reality that we experience and observe. This is a fundamental dividing line in how you approach the world and the idea or possibility of changing it. You hear all kinds of people opposing materialism by promoting what's called idealism philosophically, namely that reality is just the extension of different people's ideas. So, for example, you hear people say, well, that may be your reality, but my reality is different. God may not exist for you, but God exists for me very much. No. Either God doesn't exist for anybody or God exists for everybody. If there really is a God, I want to know about it. Because it makes everything completely different. And if there isn't a God, there isn't a God for anybody. And the Bible tells us that, you know, and other religions do. That God is God for everybody. God is not God for those who believe in those and not for those who don't. So reality is one way or the other. It is as it is. It is not as people want to create it in their minds. You hear this all the time, you know. Well, you know, different people have their own different realities. They even develop whole philosophical schools of things that are called postmodernism, where there isn't any objective reality. They're just different conceptions of reality that hold sway among different sections of people. Everybody has their own narrative. Each group in society has their own narrative that describes their reality, and nobody has anything to say or can pass any judgment on anybody else's narrative about reality. No. Reality exists objectively. If you go out of here and walk in front of a taxi cab, that reality will assert itself whether you think it will or not. And you can multiply those examples over and over again. That doesn't mean we know everything there is to know about reality at any given time, but it objectively exists and it is, and we can learn about it increasingly because it is. And because it's there objectively, and because it doesn't depend upon the thinking or the ideas or the prejudices or the wishes of people. This is a fundamental question that you can never really get free unless you understand this fundamental fact about reality, unless you're willing and able to confront and transform it on the basis of this. Let's get right down to the nut of it. Some people, when they hear me talk like this, they say, look, you can't really be an atheist. The most you can be is an agnostic. Agnostic means you don't know. You can say you don't know if there's no God, but you can't say that you know there isn't a God. And then they'll say, can you prove that God does not exist? But you see, this is backward and upside down. The way things work is, if you assert the existence of something, it's on you to come up with the evidence and proof that it exists. It's not up to me to disprove the existence of things which do not exist and for which nobody has provided evidence that they exist. That's the way we always proceed in life, if you think about it. If I tell you, for example, that when you leave here, a flying dinosaur will attack you, and all of you will be dead as a result, you would reasonably say to me, where's the proof? Where's the evidence? Would you think I would be reasonable to respond by saying, you can't tell me that dinosaur doesn't really exist. The most you can say is you're agnostic about it. No, you're going to reasonably conclude that I've gone off somewhere seriously here. And that there is no dinosaur because there's no evidence of it. The only reason that the onus, that the burden seems to be on me to prove the non-existence of a non-existing God goes back to the very beginning and what I said at the start. that this has become so deeply ingrained through the ruling institutions of society that people have been indoctrinated to think this exists, and then they want you to disprove it. But let's lay it bare and say, does it really exist? Where's the evidence? Where's the proof? If it's not there, I'm not going to believe in it. You tell me about the great flood, but there was no great flood. There's no evidence for it. I'm not going to believe in it. You tell me that human beings were created before other animals. Evolution tells me something different. I've seen that evidence. Where's your evidence? The Bible says it. That doesn't convince me. Where's the evidence? And we can go down the line. Someone once wrote, and this I thought was very striking, talking about common sense, that common sense is simply something that's so deeply embedded in the culture and in the assumptions of people that people do not really think about it or question it. It may or may not be true, but people accept it without questioning it. You can think of lots of things like that. It's common sense, for example, that if you see a star in the sky, that star exists. Well, here it gets tricky. That star did exist, but it's so far away and the light from it takes so long to get here that it may have gone out of existence by the time you see the light from that star. Common sense will not tell you that. Science can discover and reveal and explain that. And it's the same thing with all these religious prejudice and conceptions which have been handed down to different people in the world through the institutions of human beings, through the rule of very human ruling classes, and through the ideas they promote and indoctrinate people with. Otherwise, ask yourself this. It's been 3,000 or 4,000 years since Judaism was brought forward as a doctrine, 2,000 years since Christianity, 1,500 years almost since Muhammad and Islam was brought forward, thousands of years since the time of the supposed Buddha, thousands of years since the time of the Hindu gods. Why, if there really is one God, doesn't everybody by this time, for Christ's sake, believe in one God, if you'll pardon the expression? It's obvious why, because these are human institutions that developed on the basis of what emerged in different parts of the world and the battle and struggle between different forces and different empires to see which one would impose its system of rule and the ideas that went along with it. Now, materialism in the communist view also has to be combined with what we call dialectics, which is a Greek word that just means that things are clashing. It means that things are not static and unchanging. It means that things are constantly in motion, that the matter that exists is constantly developing, that there's constantly struggle and change, that there's contradiction in everything, that things have a certain identity, but that identity can and will change. For example, if you are sitting on a chair, it's solid. If you subject that chair to increased temperature, it won't be so solid. It'll burn up. That's because there is the basis within it for it to change, because molecules are moving within that chair all the time, even though it seems stable and solid. Atoms and molecules are moving, and if the right external conditions are brought to bear, they will change in a major way. You can also see that with ice and water. If you go fill up a swimming pool with ice and wait long enough, it'll melt into water if the temperature is appropriate. If you dive into it too early, it'll be a very rude and unpleasant experience. Similarly, if you have a drink and you want to put ice in it, but the ice melts and then you pour it into your drink, it waters your drink down in a way you don't like. But water can turn into ice or vice versa because the molecules are moving, because there's internal motion and change of the matter that makes up those things, and they can change from one thing to another. And things don't have just only one character and that's all. They have different aspects, things that are existing internally within them and struggling, like those molecules and atoms. And so you understand the world not as a static, unchanging thing that can never be a different way, but you begin to look at the world in terms of what is the motion, development, change. What are the contradictions that define a particular thing? And on the basis of those contradictions, how can it change to something completely different, like the capitalist system we now live under? So Marxism, communism is a critical and creative, revolutionary, scientific approach to understanding and to changing reality. And it is a scientific approach and method for unleashing the human imagination and the human spirit in that sense, in a materialist sense, and in a dialectical sense. At the same time, precisely from the point of view of communists, the dividing line today and in the future society of socialism as well, is not whether you are an atheist or not, whether you believe in God in some form and practice religion in some way. That is not the dividing line and should not be the dividing line, but where you stand in relation to the fight against oppression and whether you uphold and defend or struggle to overcome and uproot the relations of exploitation and inequality that so profoundly mark and mar and cripple society and the world today. While communists are atheists, we recognize that there are and have been many people motivated by their particular religious beliefs to do many positive, even wonderful, and extremely important things that help oppress people and aid the struggle against oppression. And our orientation, once again, is to find the broadest basis of unity and to carry forward this process of unity, struggle, unity in the battles of today and looking ahead to the future. The goal of communism, as Mao put it, is consciously and voluntarily, is getting to the point where humanity consciously and voluntarily transforms ourselves and the objective world. It is a matter of confronting reality as it actually is and as it is constantly moving and changing. And at the same time, and with that foundation and orientation, giving flight to the imagination, and in that materialist and dialectical sense, unleashing the human spirit in ways never seen and largely never even imagined or imaginable before now. Can we be good without God? The answer is yes, we have to be and we can be. Is there some inner need for God? Not when we get to a society which no longer requires consolation, which is no longer based on oppression and exploitation. Can there be meaning to life without God? Yes, definitely, communism answers. There can be the highest meaning, which is to struggle and join with others and to be part of the difficult but also at the same time joyous process of bringing a whole new world into being and a whole new future for humanity. In concluding then, let me say that for generations, centuries, and millennia, not only in those parts of the world where the Judeo-Christian tradition has held sway, but among the billion or so people who live in lands where Islam is the dominant religion, and in places where other religious and metaphysical traditions and notions are dominant. In these situations, and for these centuries and millennia, human society and the great majority of humanity have literally groaned, not only under the weight of material relations of exploitation and oppression, and the accompanying agony, poverty, and violence, but also the weight of religious notions of sin and similar concepts such as karma, for example, which have served to confuse people as to the source of their suffering and indeed have served to convince them that they themselves are responsible for this suffering, since they must have somehow acted in a way to displease some supernatural beings or supernatural forces which ultimately determine the destiny of humanity. With this in mind, let me end by referring to something I wrote in the book, Preaching from a Pulpit of Bones. With communism will come the end of sin. If sin is defined as deviation from the way of God, then objectively there is not and never has been any such thing, because there is not and never has been any God. But beyond that, when the point is reached where the material and ideological conditions exist for humanity to voluntarily and consciously change itself and the world, then there will be also no subjective basis for sin, because there will be no longer any need or basis for belief in God. At that point and into the future, there will still be right and wrong, good and bad, in the sense of what does and does not conform to objective reality, and does not contribute to forging freedom out of necessity and enhancing the ability of society and the individuals who make it up to continue developing in an all-around way. There will be that, but there will no longer be the notion of sin. And all this, will be a true, a great, an unprecedented liberation. Thank you.